Hi, you're listening to Petri.com's MJF Chat Show. I am Mary Jo Foley, aka your Petri.com community magnet, and I'm here to interview industry experts about various topics that you, our readers and listeners, want to know about. Today's MJF Chat is going to be about security hardening Windows Server. My guest today is Oren Thomas, Microsoft Principal Cloud Operations Advocate. Thanks for joining us, Oren.
No, it's great to be here.
It's bright and early for you, and it's the end of our day here. Where are you located again?
I live in Melbourne, Australia. So at the moment, it's winter. Not that we get really big winters in Australia, but I'm about half a day ahead, or 18 hours or something like that, of the US. Okay. So we get Monday morning earlier, but we get Friday afternoon faster as well.
Nice. I think I would go with your way of doing it. I really do. So we're going to talk about Windows Server. And as you noted, Windows Server ships in a mostly, quote, mostly secure configuration. But Microsoft does have to balance security with backwards compatibility. You have a bunch of ideas about things IT pros can do to tighten the security of Windows Server deployment. Things like hardening accounts and authorizations, secure administration, and hardening Windows Server from its default deployment configuration. That was hard to say. But first, before we get into all your good ideas, we asked some of the Petri.com readers if they thought Windows Server was secure from the get-go. And I want to read to you some of the things that we heard back through Twitter and various social channels.
Cool.
Okay, so Brian Reed said, is it secure out of the box? Yes, if it's deployed standalone. Maybe if it's deployed in AD with careful GPO settings. Nowhere domain and other GPO settings are a mess. Then somebody else, Paul Pryor, said, if you throw in some app locker rules and control user write assignments with GPO, lock down unused services, it's ready to rock. But also, be sure to use Windows Server Core. What do you think of these kinds of comments? Do you agree that this is the way IT pros should be thinking about Windows Server?
Yes and no. I think that one of the key things is, with anything, how you configure something will determine how secure it is. Now, when I agree with that statement that it's mostly secure out of the box, there's always a balance between backwards compatibility and compatibility with people's environments and compatibility with people's applications. And the you can actually take Windows Server far, far further. So there is two sets of third-party guidance that are really worth looking at if you're really into locking down Windows Server. So one of them is the DISA STIG, which is a Security Technical Implementation Guide, which I think is published by the US military. And that's basically a set of recommendations where they go through almost every setting that you can go and configure. And then also there's the Center for Internet Security has also got a security hardening set of guidelines for Windows Server. So coming back to those comments, you can make Windows Server very hard when it comes to a domain deployment or a standalone deployment. And there is much further that you can go than just, for example, AppLocker rules. AppLocker is actually an older technology, and we've actually got better technologies that are available for Windows Server where that sort of application whitelisting, and application whitelisting is an awesome way of approaching security, is enforced more at the hardware layer, and that you're verifying, you know, the integrity of the application or how you're identifying the application at something a bit. AppLocker is sort of an older technology. I think it's almost a decade old or a bit older now. But, you know, if you go with Windows Defender Application Control, you'll actually get a much more robust control over what runs. But the trick with any hardening is, I say, it's no point protecting a $1,000 diamond with a $20,000 safe. So you always have to be commensurate with how you harden your environment. And you can go all out and go and apply every security recommendation that might be sitting in the STIG or in the Center for Internet Security benchmark, but it might be that nothing can run on your server. So you have to balance what your threat is against how hard, how locked down you want to make the server. But Windows Server can be very, 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 very tightened and locked down, and that it's very difficult to compromise if appropriately configured.
Do you think everybody should think of this that way? In other words, do you think you brought up the dollar analogy, but like, should everyone want to lock it down to its maximum point? Or how do you gauge whether you should or shouldn't do that?
It really depends on, I mean, one of the things that we see is a big challenge, and we can see that just with the number of computer servers out there that are still running 2008, or 2008 R2.
Right.
There's a lot of simple things that people can do that they're not doing before we start worrying about some of these really complicated things, some of which I'll talk about with you today. The best thing that people can do, for example, for their domain environments, is just make sure that they're running Windows Server 2019 on their domain controllers. You always want your domain controllers to be the most recent version of the operating system. And then, you know, as a general guide, you want everything to be the most recent version. There's going to be scenarios where you can't do it for application compatibility reasons. But we also know that the vast majority of Windows Server workloads are file servers, and then domain controllers, and then infrastructure servers. And then when it comes to application servers, they're a bit further down, you know, the list in terms of common workloads. Mm-hmm. So if people just went and upgraded their domain controllers and file servers, that's a really simple thing without worrying about going into a whole set of checklists. Mm. And, you know, let's start with the easy, the low hanging fruit before we get to, you know, the more challenging bit of doing our application whitelisting, where you have to know everything that's running, which is a really great thing to do. But again, in terms of bang for your buck, you get on the latest version.
Yep. That's just like the get-go, right? Like, start there, move
yeah,
from there.
Yeah, and it's one thing that, you know, there is always a security argument that running the latest version. Why? Because it's got all of, you know, the wisdom or everything that's, you know, been dealt with before. Mm-hmm. In theory, by the time the new version's released, all of that's sort of baked into the operating system. You're not sitting there going, well, I've got to go and apply all of these updates. And that'll certainly harden the server, but we know much more when we're releasing a product today than we knew when we released an earlier version of a product.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's right. One of the readers on Petri, Ivan, asked whether these kind of guides or baselines should be applied to the majority of servers. And then also asked, security hardening, here's what he said. Security hardening is difficult to maintain operationally, as it really should be done at the application, OS, network, and identity layer. And this makes it very complex and leads to pitfalls of misconfiguration. So he's asking, are there actually practices to streamline this process? So I think these two things are related, basically.
Yeah, streamlining, it's a nice, well, it's challenging because sometimes each thing requires, you know, I mean, when you're looking at a file server, that's generally a bit easier. So if you can categorize servers, or if you can categorize workloads, you've probably then got a general set of things that you can do. But depending on how far that you want to go, and again, this comes back to this thing I was saying. If people wanted to just do the basics, that's not particularly complicated. You can go in and handcraft a security configuration, which is obviously fairly time intensive. But most people aren't anywhere near that. I mean, most people's security posture isn't that great. I was once teaching some people that were responsible for information security for the Australian government, and they were going out to government departments, and they had a set of guidelines for how things should be configured, and things were so far from where they were that even if they'd just got the basics right, they'd be doing a lot better than where you're getting all the complex things right. And there's a tendency when we're thinking about security for people to try and get everything perfect. It would be great if we were in that position, but most people actually need to get themselves just up to scratch before they start worrying about getting perfect. So it is difficult to maintain operationally. It's a matter of making sure that you document everything, you work out what works. And one of the other things that you should never do is you should never start with one of these baselines, these security hardening guides, and then turn everything on at once, because you'll do that, and what you'll find is that suddenly things won't work, and you won't know which particular security control you've implemented that might have caused the compatibility issue. So you need to be incremental about it. And obviously, if you're being incremental about it, you're actually taking more time. Time is money. Then you've got to come back to that. I've got to harden it commensurate with what my threat is. If you're running the local kindergarten's file server, that's a very different threat model to if you're running, authentication for a bank or something like that.
For sure. So do you actually advocate that people do things like you do with Windows updates? In other words, have rings and pilot testing the same way they do, or is there another approach to doing that?
So that's well, you should always test an update before you put it into production. But I was teaching teaching some students once, and one worked at an international merchant bank, and he came back with something that I found to be completely fascinating. And I don't advocate this at all, but it's a funny story, is that he said that they didn't test updates before they put them into production. And I went, "How? What's the logic in that?" And he said, "Well, we worked out the number of person hours we were spending each month testing updates before putting them into production. But we also then worked out that with our ability to roll back, we were going to spend less hours rolling back a problematic update than we were actually spending testing updates in production." So they worked out some sort of cost benefit analysis and said it's costing us X dollars to test updates every month. Given the lack of, absolutely show-stopping updates that there are, it's going to cost us a fraction of X to not test them. I don't recommend that, but it is an interesting view on the process.
It is. That's kind of a weird way of thinking, but I see where he's coming from and thinking that.
I wouldn't do it, but
No,
but again, it was what you'd get from a bunch of accountants who said, "Well, it's costing us X dollars to test. Maybe we're just better off having the occasional disaster because it'll be cheaper than all of the testing." So, yeah,
Yikes.
exactly. But again, different horses for different courses.
Exactly. I like that. So do you how do you start when you're advising IT pros, how do you actually start talking to them about this beyond what we've already said here? I mean, do you actually have a checklist and say, go down the checklist, here's what you should do, A, B, C, D, and what are those if you have those points?
So where I usually start is I start with a set of easy wins, and my first one is to just make sure that you've upgraded your domain controllers and things like that. Then I start talking about, okay, let's look at your virtualization fabric, because this is one that people don't think about so much. And with Windows Server 2016 and 2019, there's a really cool thing called guarded fabrics and shielded VMs. Because what people haven't sort of sat there and thought about is they're sitting there worrying about domain dominance when someone gets domain admin access in a domain. But they don't think about virtualization dominance, where someone actually gets control of the virtualization fabric. Because if you're controlling all of your virtualization servers, you can just pick up any VM that's running on that, export it, and then you've got access to the entire box. It's the ability of basically being able to steal. In the old days of walking into a server room and taking a server out, if you can steal a VM, it's sort of the same. So with Windows Server 2016 and 2019, you have the ability to really lock down that virtualization fabric so that each virtualization host is running in a known protected configuration. And then each virtual machine that's running on that host is fully encrypted so that if someone did try to export it, all of that they're getting is protected data that they can't read. Because one of the attacks that's happened is that people have sort of gone, oh, I'm going to go and mount the hard drive or the virtual hard disk of that domain controller, get access to the Active Directory database, run an offline attack against it, and then I've got complete access to the environment. So one thing I think I talk to people about is think about the security virtualization fabric, because a lot of people are running everything virtualized. You've got to make sure that that's hardened. The next one I talk about is obviously application whitelisting. Go and look at what applications you're allowing to run on a server, and then make sure that you're only allowing a known set of applications to run. For the most part, you're only running a limited sort of workloads. And if you think about, for example, we see all the time in the news, ransomware problems where a file server's become, had a CryptLocker infection on it. Well, there's things such as Windows Defender Application Guard, which will provide controlled folder access, which you can turn it on and it won't allow unauthorized processes to go and run on specific folders. For example, a CryptLocker infection running against a path that hosts all of an organization's files. So again, you could turn something like that on. And again, that requires that you have a more recent version of the operating system. Then things like securing your administration. A big recommendation is that you use what's called a privileged access workstation. Now, a privileged access workstation is a specially configured computer that you only perform administration tasks from that specially configured computer. And the thing's locked down so that you can only do what you're meant to do on it. It's not your sort of your daily driver computer where you're reading your email and surfing the web. It's a completely locked down environment that's got its own application whitelisting rules applied. And then you configure your servers so that they can only be managed from one of these hardened workstations. So what you're trying to do is you're trying to avoid the sort of attack or the sort of compromise where someone compromises an administrator workstation, and through compromising that workstation, they then gain access to, you know, the production servers. And one of the things I tell people at conferences is you shouldn't be doing sysadmin tasks from the laptop that you take to a conference. You should actually be doing that from a very specifically hardened workstation, a privileged access workstation.
So this is a perfect time, I think, to interrupt you for a moment with a question from another reader. Sure. More Brosit asked, best practices for allowing remote access using PowerShell PS exec.
So part of that would be to make sure that you're locking down all of your servers.
Right.
Using so that they can only be accessed from known hosts. You shouldn't have it so that you can remotely PowerShell to your domain controllers from any computer on your network. You should say, right, I can only get in from these specifically hardened workstations. And that will improve security. Security is about improvement. There's no perfect solution. But what you can do is you can make it increasingly difficult for an attacker, for example, if they've compromised your network, to move about that network. There's a thing called assume breach, which is that you design your security around the idea that you've already been compromised. So that you're trying to limit what an attacker could do if they're, for example, compromised a specific machine. Okay, if they've compromised that machine, how would we limit what they could do from that machine that they've compromised?
Yep, that's interesting.
So
I
the
think
other
I
thing
also that, oh, sorry. One other thing that I may be PowerShell related from Ivan. He was saying, other than DSC, which I'm assuming is desired state configuration, which is difficult to implement and maintain, how else can we look at maintaining the security configuration throughout its lifetime?
So there is, I'm trying to remember, there's a security compliance toolkit. Now, the security compliance toolkit is a sort of the newer version of an older tool that allows you to sort of go and check the security configuration of a server against a specific baseline. So one of the things that you can do is you can come up with these baselines and then run these tools to check how well a particular server meets that baseline. Now, there's a certain amount that you can do with DSC. There's a certain amount that you can do with Puppet and Chef, but there's sometimes there's a lot of getting out and, you know, walking when it comes to doing bits and pieces of this configuration. And because each workload may be slightly different in what its requirements are, it may be that you have to handcraft a few of these things. So there's no simple solution where you can just point a product at any workload and it'll automatically configure it. It is about understanding the workload and the requirements of that workload in terms of what you can and you can't do.
Okay. Sorry, I interrupted you. Go forward.
Okay, so one of the other ones I was going to bring up when we were talking about PowerShell is there is, of course, there's just enough administration, which is a technology that really limits what can be done with within a PowerShell session. So not only would you turn around and say, I'm going to limit where this session can come from, I can limit what can be done within the session. So, for example, someone would log in with an account that has DNS permissions and only DNS permissions. And one of the other things you want to do is you sort of want to deleverage administrator accounts. One of the other things that occurs out there is that people have these accounts that can go and do everything. And of course, if an account that can go and do everything is compromised, that means that the attacker can go and do everything. Whereas if you have an account that's really limited in what it can do, maybe all it can do is, add some DNS records or, modify a DNS zone. If that account's compromised, it really limits the scope of what an attacker can do. So, locking down admin accounts, there's within Windows Server 2016 and 2019, for example, just a silly, well, not a silly, a little thing that you can do is there's a group called the Protected Users Group. And if you add an account to this user group, it lights up all of these little security features. It disables cached logins, it disables NTLM for that account, and it'll improve the security of that account in a little way. More broadly, you might want to disable NTLM on your network if you can. And then you've got products like, well, features like Credential Guard, which again is sort of a mitigation to sort of a pass the hash attacks to those attacks that might work with Mimikatz, which is a way of sort of going in and attacking cache credentials. And then another one that's a really easy win is a thing called Local Administrator Password Solution. And what LAPS does is it makes sure that there's a unique local administrator account password on each computer that is enrolled within LAPS. One of the things that happens in a lot of environments is that there's a common local admin password on every computer in the environment. An attacker only needs to get that password once, and then they can log on to any computer as an admin. And I've seen out in the real world where even people who are just standard normal like accountants have, shoulder surfed when the IT person's come to do some work and logged in with a local admin account, and they've written that account password down and then shared it so that when the IT people aren't around and they want to do something to their machines, they just log in with a local admin account because it's using a common password right across the organization. So if you're using a local administrator password solution, you've got a unique password on each machine, so that that sort of thing cannot occur.
That's a good one for sure. Okay. Let's see. Any other kind of checklist items you think you've already brought up a bunch of good ones, but any other checklist items that people might not, it might not readily occur to them, or things that sound really simple, but you see many people not doing them?
Network isolations. Fairly good. Again, that comes down to that idea I was talking about where you're limiting who can or which hosts can open an admin connection. One of the ones that is commonly recommended is, for example, blocking critical servers from communicating in any way with the internet. The question is, why does your domain controller need to be able to get to the internet? And it probably doesn't, because if you've got your update process so that you're deploying updates through something like Windows Server Update Services, then you're deploying updates locally, and there's no need for that server to go and communicate directly with the internet. Now, again, it's not a perfect solution, but what you're doing is you're stopping the idea of it blocks someone from signing on to that server and then maybe accessing tools or downloading tools from the internet that they shouldn't. And again, that's just a one way of sort of minimizing problems that can occur. So isolate things from communicating with things that they simply do not need to communicate with. And generally your domain controllers are not going to need to communicate with the internet. There's a lot of organizations that are just like, oh, I'm not worried about anything occurring in terms of where someone might use a domain controller to access something remotely. Well, generally they're not going to need to. As someone in one of the readers suggested, running server core. And it's really surprising when I go and ask people at conferences, I say, how many people are running server core? And you'll only see a fraction of the hands go up. And there's still a perception that server core is a difficult thing to use. With the new Windows Admin Center and the functionality that's coming into Windows Admin Center, server core is a much more easy thing to administer. And for the most part, if you think again of what roles do servers generally host, things like domain controllers and file servers, they certainly don't need a GUI on them. By putting server core on, you're reducing your attack footprint. It's very difficult for someone who gets onto that server to open a browser and download something. They can still do stuff through PowerShell and obviously the command line environment. But again, server core first in terms of deploying a server, and then only not deploy server core if there's a really, really good reason not to. And if you're installing Windows Server, you already know that by default, it tells you to go and deploy server core.
Right. I'm glad you brought up Windows Admin Center, known also as Project Honolulu, because I think we should talk a little bit about that more, because I feel like people have heard about it, but maybe don't quite understand how much that's going to make their life easier.
It is. One of the things is anybody who's obviously running around on servers knows that the vast majority of the admin tools that you use to manage a server are in some cases 20 years old consoles that have been around in some form or another since sort of Windows 2000. One of the things, and we've seen things such as with some of the newer consoles like Active Directory Administrative Center, which probably came around in about Windows Server 2012-ish type timeframe. We've seen some consoles that have attempted to do something, but what Windows Admin Center represents is it represents a concerted effort to put all of the graphical administration tools that you need for a server into sort of an easily updatable web interface. So any new feature of Windows Server isn't going to get its own sort of MMC, a Microsoft Management Console, snap in anymore. It's all going to be anything new, any new functionality is going to be surfaced in Windows Admin Center or PowerShell. And one of the nice things about Windows Admin Center is when you do something, there is often a show me the PowerShell that does this button that'll actually give you the code that you could, if you just wanted to run the code, you could go and use it. So it's got add-ins. It will automatically update the add-ins. So for example, there's a feature in Windows Server 2019 called Storage Migration Service, by which our good friend Ned Pyle is responsible for. And when you install Windows Admin Center to manage Storage Migration Service, because that's the way that you manage it, if there's any updates to Storage Migration Services functionality, Windows Admin Center will automatically say, oh, by the way, this module's got updated. You click on the update and then it'll improve your console for you. So going forward, at the moment, Windows Admin Center is very, in certain areas, it's an excellent tool. Like Storage Migration Service, that's obviously how you go and manage it. There's other things that you'd still go back and, for example, with Active Directory, you'd go back and use Active Directory users and computers, because you can only do basic tasks in Windows Admin Center at the moment. However, given the rapid iterations that are going on with it, it's not unreasonable to assume that in a couple of years, you'll be have moved away completely from using those Microsoft Management Consoles, because all of the functionality that you need will be within Windows Admin Center, and that you can use that to centrally manage a lot of servers in the way that it's really difficult to do with some of those older tools.
Okay, that's good. Thanks for the shout out on that. I feel like we haven't talked about that a lot on these MJF chats, but whenever I bring it up on Twitter, people are super excited, like you said, because it's revving all the time and there's always new features being added.
It is. It's one of those things that, like I, when I'm doing Ignite Tour. It's one of those, I do a little theatre session on what's new in Windows Server. And it's one of the things that I bring up. And it's like, you really should go and look at this. It's really cool and it's getting cooler all the time. And I mean, I know now that I'm a Microsoft employee, that sounds a bit like blowing our own trumpet, but even when I was an MVP and an RD, it's a really, really, really cool feature. And I know that there's a lot of people out there that are always sort of sitting there going, look, I can probably figure out the PowerShell to do this, but it's going to take me a while and I've only got a certain amount of time. So I'm just going to default to using a GUI tool. This helps you in both ways. It allows you to do something through the GUI so that you've still got those guardrails of stopping you from doing, you know, there's also the worry when you're using PowerShell that you might accidentally summon a demon or something like that by using the wrong command. So this is giving you the guardrails, but it'll also show you the PowerShell so that if you did want to go in and script something, you're going, oh, okay, well, that's what that looks like. I can then again make that transition and start to do it from the command line should I so need. But it can be installed just on your workstation. It has its own little mini web server. You can install it, you can use it to manage stuff that's running in the cloud, or you can use it to manage a whole collection of servers. So you only need to install it once, or you can have different instances of it, and then you just go and connect through. And the other thing it's got is it's got really good integration with Azure. So that, for example, things such as Azure File Sync, which is a really cool technology that allows you to basically start tiering your file servers and putting old data up to the cloud. Again, you can set all of that up from Windows Admin Center just with a couple of clicks, because it goes, oh, go and connect your Azure account to this particular instance, and then you can go and hook that in very easily.
Cool. Very cool. Sorry, I think I got us a little off topic there, but still
That's
related.
Fine.
Yeah. So before we close out, just to reiterate, any resources that you want to call out for people on the topic of hardening Windows Server?
So the big one I would call out is I recommend that people go and look at the Center for Internet Security baseline. And also go and look for the Security Technical Implementation Guide, or the STIGs. It's worth reading through them. Now, some of them are very long, very complicated documents, but what you'll see is you'll see in some cases discussions about, here's a particular feature you might not have thought of, or a registry setting that you might not have thought of. This is what it does. And then you can figure out whether or not that's appropriate for you. Going through and looking at all of the features and all of the things and all the recommendations that exist within those baselines, and then thinking about them, you'll actually learn a lot about the process rather than, you know, just looking at someone's, this is the top 10 list of things that you can do. Because it'd be great if you did the top 10, but you probably want to go further. And I know that in my own education about all of the security features that are available, going through those very extensive baselines, I went, oh, wow, okay, I didn't know that I could do that. Or, oh, okay, I understand why I could do that. Or I can understand what that would stop me from doing if I did it. I could turn that feature on, but it would cause all of these problems.
Any Microsoft Learn courses or anything kind of course-wise that you would recommend? And you can even include your own if you would like.
Well, so there is a Microsoft official curriculum course, which is, I think it's 744, which is hardening, I think it's hardening a Windows Server environment. And in my current, which is the Windows Server 2016 Inside Out, and in the updated Windows Server 2019 Inside Out, which comes out early next year, in the updated version, I've actually added an additional chapter on just hardening Windows Server. So that one doesn't come out until early next year. But again, this is a topic that people are really interested in. So it's one of those ones that I'm covering there. At the moment, we don't at the moment have something on Microsoft Learn specifically about hardening Windows Server. But our hope is, especially with the team I'm part of, that we'll be able to get that sort of content in there at some stage.
Nice. All right, well, we are out of time, but I just want to say thanks again for coming on and talking about this topic. I know it's something a lot of our listeners and readers care a lot about. So thanks, Oren, for that.
Thank you very much.
And for all of you other regular listeners out there, we're going to be back in a couple of weeks with our next guest. So be sure to watch for that. I'll be posting the information on petri.com, and that will be your signal, listeners, to send in some questions. All you have to do is go to the MJF chat area in the forums on Petri and submit questions right there. And in regards to this chat with Oren, look for the audio and the full transcript of it, as with all of our chats, in the next few days. Thanks again.